We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. Now here's your program.
Good morning. This is Focus, our morning talk show. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producer for this program, Harriet Williamson, Jason Croft, is at the controls. Today, one in five households in America is financially insecure, and that is the highest level in the past 25 years. This morning, in this hour of the show, we'll review the results of a recent study that looks at the well-being of American families, and our guest is Jacob Hacker. He's professor of political science at Yale University. According to the Economic Security Index, which is a measure that he helped to develop, financial insecurity has risen across all groups in America, and it has hit poor households the hardest. We'll be talking in some detail about this report, which is available on the web and is something that you can read. And questions are welcome here, too. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. So those are the numbers. We also have the opportunity for email if you'd like to send along your comments that way. You may write to will-talk@illinois.edu, but we certainly welcome calls. We hope people will be on the topic and try to be brief so we can accommodate as many callers as possible, but calls are certainly welcome. Just a little bit more about our guest, Jacob Hacker. He's professor of political science at Yale. He's resident fellow at the Institution for Social and Policy Studies. He's also a fellow at the New America Foundation in Washington, D.C. He's written a lot about U.S. health and social policy. He's the author of the book, The Great Risk Shift, The New Economic Insecurity and the Decline of the American Dream. He's written a lot of scholarly articles, but also has commented often in the media and has written popular pieces for American Prospect, New Republic, Nation, New York Times, New York Times Magazine, LA Times, a number of others. He's also now working on a book that is close, apparently, to being finished, a book with Paul Pearson on inequality in American politics, that titled Winner Take All Politics. So that's something that you can look forward to. And again, the report that we're talking about here was done with a grant from the Rockefeller Foundation. And probably if you go there to their website, that would be one of the easiest ways to get the text if you'd like to take a look at it. And Professor Hacker, thank you very much.
Oh, thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Certainly, I think one of the things that you make a point of in the report is that if you ask people how they're feeling, clearly a lot of people are feeling economic insecurity. But it may be from a scholarly or a policy point of view, it's a little harder to nail that down because there are different ways you could approach this. You could look at people's income, or you could look at poverty defined by a certain level of income, or you could look at unemployment. Why is it that those things somehow you think don't really give you a complete enough picture?
Well, let me start by just saying that anybody who's interested in the index should go to economicsecurityindex.org. That's where you can get a copy of the report. I think it's up on the Rockefeller Foundation's website as well. And I also just want to mention two other quick things that were brought up by your kind introduction. One is I just wanted to say that I am just one of a team working on this index, and my team members were an integral part of this effort. And the other thing I would mention is my book, Winner Take All Politics, is actually now available for purchase.
Oh, good.
For those who are interested in my views on inequality as well as insecurity. But maybe I should say my views on insecurity before trying to get people interested in my views on inequality. So you're absolutely right. We don't have a very good measure of economic insecurity. And most of the time, we're looking at two kinds of measures. One is what people say. And for quite a while, Americans have been saying that they're feeling economically insecure. The numbers were very high in the last couple of years, but they were high as well prior to the Great Recession. And one of the puzzles we were trying to figure out in our work was whether or not there was an underlying reason why we've seen this long-term increase in the degree to which people say that they're insecure. But the reason that we felt we had to take on this task of developing a new measure is that most of the measures we have really aren't about economic insecurity. If you think about insecurity, it's really about fear of something happening, of change. And most of the measures we have are really measures of what people are experiencing at a particular moment. So, for example, how many Americans are poor or how many are unemployed? Our measure is a measure of how many Americans experience a big decline in their resources. And more specifically, we look at the chance or the share of Americans who experience a 25% or greater decline in their available family resources. And those are just their family income, all sources, government and private, minus their medical costs and the amount they spend to pay down their debt. So we're really just looking at how much money do you have left over after medical care and debt service to deal with economic contingencies and events. And we're asking what share of people had a 25% or greater fall, a quarter drop or greater in that measure of available resources. That's a big drop if you think about it. $50,000 a year family income would have to go down to $37,500 or less before we even counted them. So when we say one in five experienced a decline of that magnitude, we're talking about a really serious level of economic insecurity in the United States.
And how does that compare with economic insecurity, let us just say, over the last decade maybe, or any time frame that you want to pick?
Well, we were interested in having the longest time frame for the obvious reason that, you know, any of these measures can only really be understood in comparison across groups or over time. I mean, we know one in five is high, but how much higher is it than the level 20 or 15 years ago or 30 years ago? As it turned out, the source of data that we used allowed us to go back 25 years, which is a nice, number for, a quarter century. So we went back to the early 1980s. And as you know, the early to mid-1980s were a very difficult economic time. Nonetheless, the level of the index was about 12% at the beginning of our series. So 12% of Americans experienced a year-to-year drop of their family resources of a quarter or greater. And now it's, of course, 20%. It's gone up and down. It generally goes up and down with the performance of the economy. So when the economy is bad, more people are insecure. But what we found is that taking out that up and down trend and just looking at the long-term rise, there's nonetheless been a very significant increase in economic insecurity over the last 25 years. I'd also say that although we can't look at all the components of our index, particularly we can't look at medical care and debt prior to the mid-1980s, we can look at the chance that you'll experience a drop in your income, just your income, your earnings and your government income and any other income you receive. And what we found is that if you go back to the 1960s, which is when we can go back to using that evidence, that even before the mid-1980s, there was a decline in economic insecurity. That is, there are more people experiencing these large declines. So the long-term trend has definitely been towards greater economic insecurity, but it's fluctuated up and down with the performance of the economy. I think what's really notable is that even before this downturn, economic insecurity was already quite high, and that given what we know about the sort of expected performance of the economy over the next decade or so, we could see very elevated levels of economic insecurity for some time to come. In other words, this is really something that could be a problem that we're grappling with as a society and as individuals for some time, and we need to start thinking about how to do that.
Yeah. Just very quickly, to introduce again the guest, we're talking with Jacob Hacker. He's professor of political science at Yale University and has written a lot about the politics of health and social policy here in this country. And we're talking about something that he and a number of other people work together on, the Economic Security Index, which is a way at looking at financial insecurity, not just perceived financial insecurity, but actual financial insecurity. And what they have found is that it is at the highest level that it's been in the past 25 years. And again, this report is available if you'd like to read it in some more detail. And his suggestion is just go to economicsecurityindex.org, and that is a way that you can find it. Questions are welcome, 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. And you can also email will-talk@illinois.edu. Can you talk a little bit about specifically what is going on, what has led to this increase in economic insecurity?
Well, let me say two things there. First is that when we started, we didn't know whether or not this increase that we see in people's perceptions would actually be borne out by the underlying evidence. So I think it's very important to understand that not only are people feeling insecure, but there's definitely this trend towards increasing chance of economic loss. And we also didn't have strong presumptions about who was affected by these trends. I guess that the sort of standard view of most Americans, I think, is that there are people who are insecure, who are at the bottom of the economic ladder, but that, you know, middle class and upper middle class Americans are relatively immune from these trends, or at least that was the view prior to this downturn. But what we found was that all demographic groups have experienced an increase. Really, there were very few that didn't have at least some rise in economic insecurity over this 25-year period. So that really calls on us, when we're thinking about an explanation, to think about something that affects all Americans. It can't just be that, you know, those who are in the most poorly paid jobs or people who have single-parent households are the cause of this overall rise. It can't be a change in the proportion of different demographic groups in the population that's explaining a rise that's happening within all demographic groups. So we don't have a definite answer yet. In fact, one of the important aspects of this index is that we're going to be producing a series of reports about different components of it. But our hypotheses, our guesses, our hunches, to give them a little bit more strong grounding, are that this is driven mostly by the increasing instability of earnings. And in particular, it's driven by the increasing instability of people's either employment, right, whether they're employed or not. We know that there's been an increase, for example, during this downturn in unemployment as well as long-term unemployment, people out of the workforce for a long time, and in the variability of earnings even when people remain employed, either because they're required to change jobs or because their hours are cut back. What we've seen over the last generation, according to a number of scholars, including myself, is a shift of risk from employers onto workers. And that means that some employees do very well. They're bearing the risk and they get the reward, whereas other workers are finding that they have much more uncertain economic prospects. They're more likely to find themselves with skills that they can't use in their present job or facing cutbacks in their pay or their hours than was true in the past. The kind of older model of a long-term employment contract where people really could be guaranteed a steady and indeed increasing wage seems to have disappeared over the last 15 or 20 years and really over the last generation. And that's the most fundamental cause of what we're seeing. Mm-hmm. The other thing I'll just mention in passing is that clearly medical costs have become a much bigger part of family income. And we do, in the index, take into account medical costs by saying that families that experience a big decline in income after their medical costs are insecure. So that could mean that if your medical costs go way up in 1 year, your available income could decline. Now, what we found is that medical costs don't seem to be driving the upward rise as much as instability of income. But medical costs are part of this. And as more and more Americans spend upwards of 10 or 15% of their income on medical costs, more and more are going to get pushed over that threshold. And that's one of the reasons why I think bringing down healthcare costs, the rate of increase of healthcare costs is so vital, because it is really a threat to family economic security quite directly, because it limits the ability of families to spend on other things that they value, their food, their housing, their education, and so on.
Well, this I think is particularly important, and I know that this is an issue that is of great interest and concern to you yourself in your academic work, that is access to healthcare or lack of access to healthcare. But it seems to me pretty significant that here you fix on really two big things. One thing that you would expect, and that is instability in employment, either people losing their jobs or maybe losing a job and then getting another but having a job that pays less. You know, that's perfectly understandable that that would contribute to economic insecurity. But the other major piece here is the amount of money that people are having to spend on their health care. So it seems like you can't really underestimate just how big a thing that is.
No, you can't. And remember that our measure in some ways is very conservative. And here I use the term conservative simply to say that we're trying not to overestimate the likelihood that people will experience these large declines. And I think one logical way to think about insecurity is that we face insecurity not just when we experience a big decline, but also when we have persistently constrained resources. So there are lots of families that are spending 30 or 40% of their income on medical care. This is particularly true of elderly households who are spending that amount year after year after year. And so we're going to do a supplemental report really looking at those families and their circumstances, because that's a form of insecurity, as well as the more dynamic, you know, year-to-year change version that we look at in our report. But I would say that, just to sort of bring us away from some of the index and the data, that really the thing that this confirms is Americans' intuition about their own economic lives. I mean, when we poll Americans, when we did our own independent poll to design this index, what we found is that about half of Americans felt like a 25% or greater loss in their income would put them into real hardship. And that was one of the reasons we chose that threshold. But we also found independently through our own research that that's about the level that people can sustain. Mm-hmm. What people also say is they don't have a big personal financial safety net. So one aspect of our index that I didn't mention up front, but it doesn't really change our story very much, is that we said, okay, if you experience this big decline, if you have enough money to be able to make up that loss in savings, in easily accessed wealth, then we're not going to count you as insecure. Well, the truth is we ended up not ruling out many people because of that, because not that many people have that kind of financial wealth. So when people say, we don't feel like we have a financial safety net, they're right. The median, the typical person, has no net financial wealth. That is, outside their home, they have none. And that was really striking to us. And that's a change, actually. There's been a bit of a decline, and there's certainly been a big increase in indebtedness at the bottom. So we face, as a country, a kind of national economic problem, one that we hear a lot about. We have high levels of unemployment, slow economic growth. We're struggling with the worst financial crisis since the Great Depression. But what we really wanted to do is get it down to the personal, to the kitchen table discussions of families. And for families, they see these problems through the prism of their own economic circumstances. And what we wanted to show policymakers and interested parties and Americans themselves is that there's real content to these concerns that people have. And hopefully in doing so, we can draw attention to it. The press coverage of the index has really been gratifying for us, because it's really drawn attention to a theme that we keep stressing, that this is not something that's just affecting a tiny, tiny minority of Americans. It's really part and parcel of the economic experience of large numbers of Americans today. And we're going to have to start addressing it as such, not as a kind of peripheral concern for those left behind.
Mm-hmm. But I think that it's also true, in as much as you say that this trend has affected everyone. And if you look at the range of incomes and you take it into slices the way demographers do, and you look at how people are doing all the way along the continuum, while it may be that everybody is affected and maybe the only people who don't have to worry about it are the people at the very top, it is also true that people who are on the bottom end are the effect here is disproportional, so it does way more heavily on people than that are in the bottom. Maybe one of the big changes is that it also now weighs pretty heavily on people who are also in the middle.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right about both points. What we found is that when you compare the top and the bottom fifth of Americans in terms of income, that the chance of the share of people experiencing this kind of large decline in income is about twice as high in the bottom fifth than in the top fifth. But at the same time, as I said, every group but the very top has experienced an increase. And it's more and more an experience, I think, that the middle class, the sort of politically crucial middle class, has started to experience. Now, we're not making a political statement here in the sense that we're not proposing a set of policy solutions, nor do we think that that there's an implication here that that Americans who fear or face economic insecurity should have a certain political view about how it should be addressed. However, I do think that the sort of confrontational and polarized nature of American politics today, the big fights that we're seeing taking place, are really revolving around a debate over whether and what role government should play in dealing with a set of economic strains that are now really affecting the middle class in a way that may not have been true a generation ago. And to me, as a political scientist, you know, what's really important is that we understand that historically government has played a role, and at least since the 1930s and really even before that, in providing economic security. And so it's inevitable that we're going to have that debate, and we should be having it with open eyes about the nature of the underlying trends that we're talking about.
Mm-hmm. Well, just to, I think you've spoken to this question already, but I want to maybe come back for a moment to the idea of long-term trend and whether that's what this is, because I imagine that there were some people who would be prepared to argue that, yes, things are bad now, and they've been bad for a couple of years, but we've had a significant downturn in the American economy, and the hope is, while it might take some time, maybe even another couple of years, that we'll somehow manage to get back to where we were. So the question would be, is what we're seeing right now a dip, and will we climb out of it, or is what we're looking at here something that really is a long-term trend, and if you graph this out and you continue to project it forward, that the line of that represents people experiencing economic insecurity is just going to continue to climb up and up?
Well, we can only speak, you know, of the past as researchers and who are constructing an index. However, and you know, like all of the stock analysts who say past performance is no predictor of future success, we should always be wary of forecasting lines indefinitely forward. Mm-hmm. My favorite line on this was came from a former economist in the Nixon administration, Herb Stein, who said, if things can't go on forever, they won't. So there are trends that will interrupt themselves. However, we find a very strong upward trend that is independent of the business cycle that goes on for 25 years. The 2001 downturn was worse than the 91 downturn. And the 2009-2010 downturn has, of course, been far worse than either of those, and that's true in our index as well as in on broader economic indicators as well. The projections about where we're going have varied a lot from analyst to analyst, but they all, I think, recognize that not only do we face a kind of long-term fallout from the economic crisis that we've gone through, but also that the job market and our healthcare system have both changed in ways that are increasing economic insecurity. So I think the main reason for optimism would be that there is a new set of responses, either by the private sector or by government, to these trends. And the healthcare bill is obviously one response. Those like me who are involved in the struggle over it believed it was essential to have a basic level of health security provided to all Americans. But at the same time, I was and remain very critical of the bill's failure to really tackle the long-term cost problem. The other set of responses that that we might see either in the private sector or from government, though I think obviously given the current downturn, it's really government that is going to have to take the lead in reviving the economy in the short term, would be a real heavy emphasis on trying to sort of set the foundation for a new type of job market in which people have higher skilled jobs, where they're trained more quickly to relocate to new jobs, where there's perhaps more pressure on employers to pay good wages and benefits coming from unions. Whatever the mix is, it would be a mix that was creating a different kind of job market going forward. And at the moment, I don't think that we can confidently declare. In fact, I know we can't confidently declare, and I don't even think we can expect that that's going to emerge without further action. And, you know, to me, that's the real tragedy of the gridlock that's likely to befall us politically for the next few years. And then I want to try to be upbeat because I actually know that we as a society have tackled problems like this many times before and come through with flying colors. The GI Bill was a great contributor, for example, to middle-class economic security by training and millions of Americans who are returning from the war, of creating this part of the foundation of the middle class by creating a democracy that was based on broad citizen influence. I mean, there's the New Deal and key programs of the New Deal, like Social Security, I think were quite successful as well in freeing people from economic angst. So to me, there is precedent for a positive response, but we've yet to see, I think, the kind of concerted action, either private or public, that would be necessary.
We are at our midpoint here, and we have a caller I'll get to in just a minute, but I'd like to also introduce again our guest, Jacob Hacker. He's professor of political science at Yale University. He's done a lot of writing about the politics of U.S. health and social policy. He's author of a book that was published a number of years ago and then has been updated. So if you're interested, you can look for The Great Risk Shift, The New Economic Insecurity and the Decline of the American Dream. Also a book that is brand new and just out, a book that he has co-authored. It's titled Winner Take All Politics, How Washington Made the Rich Richer and Turned Its Back on the Middle Class. It is just out. It's published by Simon & Schuster. So if you're interested, you can seek that book out. And also, if you'd like to look at some detail at the issue of economic insecurity that we've been talking about here, he is one of a team of people who crafted this measure of economic insecurity that they write about in a report which came out in July, Economic Security at Risk, Findings from the Economic Security Index. And there, if you'd like to look at it and you have internet access, you just go to economicsecurityindex.org and you can take a look at it. Questions are welcome here, too. We have some people who are getting lined up in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455, email will-talk@illinois.edu. And we have some callers here. We'll start off with someone in Chicago on our toll-free line, line 4. Hello.
I'm thinking of the height of security would probably be represented by a monopoly, or given that next step up would be an oligarchy and then finally a monarchy. But not having that in our personal lives, we then recognize that the role of government is so important, and those who function within particular government have to abide by those rules. But those who evade the rules and shirk their responsibilities and decide to send their abilities and resources overseas, therefore somewhat and still functioning within the auspices of the government, but then depriving those who are hoping to exist in the economic job world the opportunity, because the resources of the foundations and the government and so forth have been shifted away from the local level to overseas functionings. Besides the military, we can think of Economic Security Index Foundation by the Rockefeller Center. I recall decades ago where they decided, given the tax structure of things, they would have to shift their operations to function overseas so that they could have a better tax climate to perform, and we see the shifting of jobs and everything overseas, therefore undermining our notion of security when all these things are sort of shifting and eroding the base upon which we would have a productive society and so forth. So we see the shifting of overseas and much of our economic stability, and the evasion of the responsibility of the corporations by shifting their tax structures overseas, even to the point where they don't even pay taxes. So we have a climate there between the operation of government and businesses undermining the basis upon which individuals would hope for security here. Well, that's a big mouthful, but as I say, you put your money where your mouth is, and apparently the people who have the money are left the ship. Thank you very much for your calls. I'll listen off the air.
All right. Well, there are several very large issues there. I don't know if you want to pick that apart and take a couple of things that you feel you can respond to.
Well, I actually think that the broad theme that the caller was hitting on, namely what effect does the growing globalization of our economy have on our economic security, is one that really requires us having a frank and extended discussion. I'll try to be frank and short. The fact is that most countries, rich countries, have faced growing pressures from the global economy, but not all of them have experienced the same rise in inequality and insecurity that the United States has. So I think a very important question is how do different countries, how do their public policies or the actions of their workers or corporations, how do they mitigate some of the negative effects of globalization that we all know about. For example, the growing there's certainly evidence that when workers are facing a global economic environment in which they're competing with low-wage workers in other countries, that workers have less skills in the United States or in the other countries facing rich countries facing foreign trade might have downward pressure on their wages. There's insecurities and uncertainties that are produced by the ability of companies to move across borders. So one of the things that I've been thinking about in my work, both on inequality and security, is how important is globalization in these trends. And you know, the surprising conclusion of a lot of researchers, myself included, is that globalization has created this big shock, but that how countries respond to that shock is really what matters for what effects it has on the economic security or the quality, economic inequality of the society. And I would just mention two things in passing in that regard. One is that a lot of countries have actually retooled their labor markets to make them at once more secure and more flexible. Sometimes this is called flexicurity, which is a mouthful to me. But Denmark is often held up as an example of this. And without extolling any one country, I think this makes sense that in a more dynamic, vibrant economic environment, you don't want your labor market to be subject to a lot of rigidities due to restrictions on hiring and firing. But at the same time, In an economy that's based more on skills and knowledge and where people are moving from job to job more frequently, you want to try to make it so that economic security moves with people from job to job. And I think that's one of the reasons why we need to have a healthcare system that really de-links employment for a particular employer and receiving health benefits. It's also a good reason to have retraining programs or to have unemployment benefits that are designed to encourage people to have the time to be able to retrain, but also to get into jobs that will have good pay and benefits. So those are some of the points about flexicurity that I would make. Mm-hmm. The other side of it is inequality. And the caller hinted at something that's actually true, and that is that we have seen a big decline in the effective tax rates on the richest of Americans. We write a lot about this in my co-author Paul Pearson and I write a lot about this in our book, Winner Take All Politics. But many countries have seen a similar decline at the very top, but no country has seen the kind of rise of the super rich like the United States has. And if it would be one thing, I think, if that rise of the super rich, you know, the top 0.1% or 0.01%, which has seen its incomes fly through the stratosphere, if that rise had been accompanied by gains in economic security and well-being for the middle class. But as the Economic Security Index suggests, those gains have been much more elusive. And so to me, that's why inequality is worrisome, not so much because it's bad in itself that we have rising inequality, but because it looks like a bad bargain for most Americans to have the top getting so much of the gains of economic growth when they're facing economic uncertainties and strains. And I would just submit, that, as I argue in Winner Take All Politics, that one of the reasons it's bad is that it really does matter for our democracy whether or not people feel as if they have a strong ability to participate in the economy and get a fair deal from it, and that political equality and economic greater political equality requires that, you know, we have a society in which our government is responsive to all Americans and not disproportionately responsive to those at the very top.
Mm. All right. I want to thank the caller. Go on to another. And this is someone, I believe, in Urbana, line one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Yes. It seems to me that part of the trouble in creating any reform is that there is a fairly sizable group among those in power who actually favor the maintenance of economic insecurity as a driving force to keep wages down and to increase productivity, and that you see this very clearly in the politics of the moment, that any move towards securing free admittance to labor unions and such is bitterly fought. Would you comment on this?
Well, I might not put it exactly the same way, but I actually think that you make a very important point. I mean, you mentioned productivity, and I think it's very important for people to understand that most of the gains of productivity growth over the last generation or so have been distributed very unequally. Mm-hmm. And that's one of the points that we make in Winner Take All Politics in the book that I was talking about before, that when we look at all government spending and benefits and taxes as well as private income, so we look at the full package of what people receive, and we look at different points in the income distribution, what we found is that you have to get up to about the top 10% before the overall gains you find people who are receiving income gains in their household that are equal to the overall growth of the economy. So below the top 10%, everyone receiving less than they would have had they received the average income growth within the economy. And that's just another way of saying that there's been a big skew in income to the top and particularly to the very, very top. And I do think part of the reason for that is that we've seen a big decline in the power of labor unions. And I do think that there's political support for that weakened role of unions, or political opposition to measures that might help unions. But I think this goes well beyond organized labor. The tax cuts of 2001 and 2003 were merely the latest in a long string of tax cuts that were pretty well tailored to produce gains for those at the very top and not much for those below them. There was also a big push to deregulate financial markets. So now I'm speaking here much more about inequality than insecurity, though I think the two are interwoven. And I want to be clear that the Economic Security Index really isn't about the political sources of these trends. It's really about what's happened to the economic security of Americans. But in this book with Paul Pearson that I'm now talking a little bit about, Winner Take All Politics, we really try to unpack why it is that we've seen this big gain in income at the very top. And our answer is, surprisingly perhaps, is that government and policy and politics play a big role. I don't think it's a conspiratorial role. I think it's really about the fact that money has become more important in politics, and organized groups representing the middle class and those below them have weakened. And so the pressure in politics is more and more reinforced rather than offset the distribution of economic rewards to the top.
It seems to me there's also an industry, not so much small business, but the large businesses, to regard the American citizens as purely consumers, that they can import their goods they manufacture overseas and sell to them, which in the long run, of course, is untenable.
Well, I would say that corporate America in the United States, for the most part, has been very hostile to unions historically, and the great pro-union parts of the workforce and pro-union parts of the business community have atrophied because manufacturing has declined dramatically. But I would say that, you know, corporations, for the most part, in the U.S. and other countries, you know, adopt a set of strategies for achieving profits and other goals that are shaped for them by what the policies are in place. And I think if we had had a different set of policies in the United States and from roughly the late 1970s on, there would have been far less of this big rise in corporate CEO pay, far less pressure to try to cut back on unions. So in other words, I would sort of be with your first point about the importance of those in power. And I think that we should understand that for the most part, corporations are really very strategically responding to what the economic environment is. We also have I would just want to emphasize that there are good things that come with having a very dynamic entrepreneurial economy, one where historically we've been much more likely to invest in research and education than other countries. And I fear that we're going to lose that if our political system becomes more and more ossified. We've already seen ourselves falling behind other countries in terms of the share of citizens completing college. And that was a leadership that I think really undergirded our massive transformation to become the world leader in the economy and then in the technological realm. And so I think we are a productive, dynamic society in which we're open to new ideas. And I believe that the ideas that I would put forth that draws on this Economic Security Index's findings and on my work on inequality is that there's no guarantee that that will be true in the future, and that the key way in which to achieve that is to really make sure our politics works better, to think about the long term and to think about the, you know, the vast middle rather than catering to small segments of the population or small slices of the income distribution.
We just have about 10 minutes left here in this hour focus. Just again, very quickly, let me mention that our guest is Jacob Hacker. He's professor of political science at Yale University, has written a lot about the politics of U.S. health and social policy. Just quickly here, I want to get back to the Economic Security Index just for a second, and just again mention that as you've discussed, there are really three things that go into this. One is a big loss of income. One is big out-of-pocket costs for medical expense. And the third is the lack of an adequate financial safety net, so people having savings, essentially, something that they can fall back on. Now, you have been somebody who's really was vocal in when we were having the debate about health care reform, and sort of in the interest of full disclosure, I know that you were somebody who really contributed to the idea of the public option and really advocated for that. If we had something like that, or we just had some kind of a system so that people didn't have to worry about their medical cost, but that knew if they got very sick or if someone in their family got very sick that they would be taken care of. How far would that go to address the issue of economic insecurity?
I think it would go an enormous direction, and I say that for two reasons. One is dealing with our medical care problems is actually probably easier than many of the other economic challenges we face. And that may surprise you after the two years of debate we had. But as I pointed out in a lot of my work writing about the public option, most countries have done a much better job of restraining the rate of increase in medical costs than we have. Our public programs have done a better job than private health insurance in doing so. And those countries and programs that have done a better job have nonetheless achieved better outcomes, both in terms of the quality of care and in terms of the security of those who have coverage. So I think that if we were serious about the long-term challenge of bringing healthcare costs under control and making sure that all Americans had at least a basic level of coverage, we would definitely reduce, if not really eliminate, because I think that's impossible, one of the major sources of strain on family finances. You know, you've probably seen the research suggesting that a good share of personal bankruptcies are due in part to medical costs and crises. Mm-hmm. What's often not mentioned in that research is that you go to other countries and the idea of medical bankruptcy is actually foreign, no pun intended, to most people. You say, you know, how many people have to declare bankruptcy because of medical costs, and they wonder what you're talking about, because it just doesn't happen to anything like the same degree. So I think that's right. I would say, going back to the three things that you mentioned, I think it's very important that people understand that the index does have these three components, whether you have a large income loss, whether you face large medical out-of-pocket costs, and whether you lack an adequate safety net. So it seems to me that there's a pretty straightforward, if not easy, to implement a set of prescriptions there. If we deal more comprehensively with medical care going forward, that will help. If we try to think more about why it is that that family incomes are more unstable than they used to be, and I've already mentioned some of the reasons having to do with changes in the labor market, I would also say that there are reasons having to do with changes in families. Some of those are not going to change. I don't think we're ever going to go back to the kind of 1950s model family, but at least we can say, okay, if people experience major family dissolution, if someone's growing up in a family where they only have one parent, how can we at least make it easier for those families to deal with economic strains? And then I would say, lastly, and I think this is the area where we need to really focus our energies, because almost everyone, conservative as well as liberal, agrees that something has to be done. We need to get people's balance sheets, their personal balance sheets, back into not just into the red, but into the red for the long term. We need to make sure that people are able to save adequately for retirement, for education, for unexpected contingencies in their lives. And here's a case where inequality and insecurity come together, because right now we have all these tax breaks for savings. They're scattered all over the place that are worth by far the most to people at the top of the income ladder. So I think one very simple prescription would be to say, let's create more incentives for middle and working class Americans to save so that they aren't receiving, you know, modest tax breaks or not even getting an opportunity to save at their place of work while people higher on the income ladder have all of these tax-favored accounts that are worth that give them a lot in tax breaks because they have such so much higher incomes and therefore higher tax brackets.
All right. Let's go to we have some other callers. We'll try to get them in and go next to line two, someone in Champaign. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Good morning.
Yes.
Right along with everything you've been talking about, I've been feeling that one of the things that's happening, and I saw this echoed in a report on the NewsHour on PBS, is that you wonder why more jobs haven't been created by the money that's been invested by the government. And anecdotally, all over, you see that corporations have discovered that the short-term look is how you look at things, and the way you do that is you take the workers you have and you work them longer hours. These are salaried people, and so you don't employ someone else. You make the people you have work harder and longer, and your productivity goes up, and it looks just wonderful, and your profits for your stockholders go up. But in fact, you're not creating the jobs that are right there. You're just asking other people to work harder and longer, and it's a terrible thing to be in that position, and people are afraid to say anything because they might lose their job. I don't know how you make corporations behave better, but I think that's an enormous problem.
Yeah, I agree. I actually think that we now have enough evidence from how both this recession and we have even more evidence with regard to the last one that began around 2001. We have a lot of evidence that suggests that just the kind of behavior that the caller was talking about. Corporations seem to be much more likely to hoard labor than they were in the past and than are corporations in other countries. And I'm not sure why, but it certainly underscores the problem of jobless recoveries that we've seen in both those periods. We are deep into the hole, as is often said. We have millions of jobs that have been lost, and we're right now at a level of private sector job growth that means that we're not even keeping up with population growth. And the only way that's going to change, right, is that there is a wave of hiring. Now, we do see some of that coming back, and I think this story that the caller tells is less true of smaller employers than of larger employers. But I think we're going to have to try to figure out why it is that corporations have become more likely to rely on productivity increases and extra hours among their present workers than hiring. It may well be that part of this is the sort of downside of a very good development, which was the move towards much more just-in-time production, where firms really were trying to respond much more quickly to cyclical changes in demand, which allowed them not to have to lay people off. So there was less of this kind of unemployment that was basically having people sit out of the labor force and go back to the same job. But the flip side of that is, if there's less of that kind of, you know, cyclical unemployment, we have more and more structural unemployment, people who lose a job and really are out of the labor force for a long time and need to find a new kind of job. And the other thing is we just don't have hiring, right? We really need that. And how to spur that? You know, the government seems to be very good at spurring or at least retaining public sector employment. But that is, of course, you know, not a sustainable strategy for long-term growth. And we're going to have to really explore as a society, as a government, how we're going to deal with that.
Okay. We're very short on time. I want to try, though, to get one more caller. We'll go to Mokina. This is line four. Hello.
Yeah, thank you. I'll try to make it short. I'm a small business owner. Okay, they're not making it affordable for me to hire anybody. And right now I can't because of the taxes and regulations of both the federal government and the state put on me. And it's virtually impossible unless you have got a big bankroll to throw out there, and it all has to do with the political game. And to you, in my opinion, get rid of the money aspect out of politics, it's just going to get worse because there's too much out there reason why. If I give somebody $10,000, he's going to listen to me. If I give the guy $10, he's not going to listen to me. And that's the problem with the lobbyists and other people involved with that.
Yeah,
that's my statement. I'll get off.
I appreciate the comment. I can give you, Professor Packer, I can give you about a minute.
Well, I'll keep it really short because the comment was pretty much spoke for itself. I think many small employers feel that way. I mean, one of the things I was really struck by during the health care reform debate, in which I was often next to representatives of small employers testifying on Capitol Hill, was the extent to which small employers are often cast as being, you know, and their representatives as being reflexively anti-government. That wasn't at all my sense. My sense was what they really want is a climate where they can do what they do well, and they really dislike the deep political uncertainties they face. And at the same time, they really do feel like they get the short end of the stick in the Washington lobbying world and when it comes to these private benefits that large employers can provide but small employers can't. So I think that a pro-small business strategy would consist of really making it so that small employers don't have to deal with the hassles, administrative and hassles and costs of providing all these benefits, and that it's much more something that's done on a citizenship basis that's free of any particular employer. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure the caller would agree with that, but all I can say is that I really do recognize that small employers really do feel like they're bearing the brunt of our sort of backward strategy for providing economic security.
Well, if folks would like to read more about the Economic Security Index, something that our guest Jacob Hacker was involved in putting together, you can go to the website economicsecurityindex.org and look at the report, which came out in July. Also, you might want to look for a new book, which Jacob Hacker has co-authored, the title Winner Take All Politics, How Washington Made the Rich Richer and Turned Its Back on the Middle Class. It's just out, published by Simon & Schuster. And our guest, Jacob Hacker, is professor of political science at Yale, speaking to us from the studio there. We want to thank Phil Kearney, who's the engineer at that end. And Professor Hacker, thank you very much for talking with us.
Well, thank you. It was a fascinating discussion.